me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk, real people, real stories. The He's Just Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Today, we're joined by someone whose life work has been rooted in advocacy, truth, and love, both in the courtroom and at home. Stephen Eichenblatt, a graduate of Florida State University and the University of Florida College of Law. Stephen is a practicing attorney with decades of experience, a dedicated father of five, and a tireless advocate for children and families. From serving as a pro bono guardian ad litem to representing the families of first responders lost on 9/11. Stephen has spent more than 30 years standing up for those whose voices often go unheard. But beyond his legal accolades and community honors, Stephen is here with us today in a different role, as an author, a father, and a man, reflecting on the complex intersections of resilience, trauma, and the bonds that hold or sometimes fray within families. His new memoir, Pretend They Are Dead, A Father's Search for the Truth, is a deeply personal journey that invites us to explore how pain can echo through generations, how silence can speak volumes, and how fatherhood, at its most honest, can open a path toward healing. Today, we'll speak with Stephen, not just about the book, but about the stories behind it, the estrangements, the second chances, and the quiet strength it takes to face our past for the sake of our children's future. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jules, for having me. It's an honor to be here with you today on the 99th show.
I'm excited just as much as you. And I want to tell everyone right now, even though that you're in Orlando, you're really a Jersey, New York guy anyway, just to get us started. But friend, take us away. How did you get involved in this journey, in this walk, and being an attorney? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in Jersey. I'm a Jersey boy. You can't take it out of you. My grandfather was a bus driver in Jersey City. My father grew up in Bayonne. Unfortunately, the way I got involved in the book and my journey is my father left when I was about 6 years old. Parents got divorced. And one day I showed up at my house with my grandparents, and there was a new man there, and he is introduced as, this is your new father, these are your new brothers and sisters. And from that point forward, and his name was Richard in the book, he laid down these rules in the house that were very difficult to live with. For example, we weren't allowed to walk in the front door. We had to go around to the back. We were not allowed to sit on the furniture. We had to sit on the floor. Unlike families being, you know, encouraged to eat meals with your parents, we were not allowed to eat any meals with our parents, and we weren't even allowed to be in the kitchen. So it was a pretty hostile, it was a hostile environment. And then you have seven kids in a small area, four brothers and sisters I hadn't met before. I have a twin sister and a biological brother, so we were all thrown in together. And with a new father, a new family, and I call it the Brady Bunch from hell, but that's kind of what started it, and that led me on the journey to law school and writing the book.
I had an opportunity to glimpse through, and I don't want to give too much away, but this is a powerhouse, for real. Your life, the way that you were able to let us in, and tell us a little bit about how difficult it is to be you and to live within this household. You know, within your book, you had mentioned sometimes you write to heal. How was writing this memoir be part of that healing process, if you will.
It really brought back not just the good, some good memories, although I don't have a lot of great memories as a child, but it really got me in touch with the things that bothered me. And I didn't even realize how much they bothered me, being thrown in that house. And it made me reflect on who was I really supposed to be? Because I got thrown this curveball. My biological father just disappears one day. He's gone, no explanation. And my parents get married. They don't tell us. And it really, you know, going back and going through those difficult things really helped heal what was inside of me, because I was living with a lot more pain than I thought. I was living with things that I had forgotten had even occurred. I have brothers and sisters that will not talk about the past, refuse, absolutely won't talk about it, won't go there. But I think it really helped. And it's a continuing process. It's a continuing process. I still I get counseled. I still have issues that I deal with, but I'll work on it till I'm dead, really. I mean, it was really good exercise for me.
Mm. Can you tell us how did therapy shift your understanding of yourself, and not just as the father or the husband, but just the man trying to make sense of some of this pain?
You know, therapy at the beginning, when I first realized that I needed to see some kind of help, it was triggered by, you know, relationship issues. You know, I went through a couple marriages. I was always told I was just disconnected. You're a disconnected person, Steve. Everybody loves you, but you are disconnected. And, you know, and you can't be intimate, like not sexually, but I mean, just like, I didn't even understand what it meant. You know, I grew up in a house, there was no I love yous, there was no hugs, there was coldness. There was a lot of just pure coldness. So therapy helped me realize that my childhood was not normal, and that I grew up in a house, as did many of my generation, where you had to be tough. You know, you were not allowed to show any signs of weakness. You were not allowed to cry. You're not allowed to be emotional. And if you did, you know, there was punishment, you know, physical. So I lost a lot of my emotion that was inside of me. And by going to therapy and starting to work my way backwards and going through what I went through as a kid, I started realizing, wow, you know, having your father beat the crap out of you, that doesn't happen to everybody. There are things, you know, some of the things that happened in my household, those things are not normal. And being told that you're a loser, or listening to watching your father beat your mother, those are not things that, I mean, obviously those are not good things, but when you're a kid, when you are living in a house, like a lot of the kids that probably you see in your middle school or as a social worker, you see these kids, they're just used to chaos, but it doesn't make it right. So going through therapy made me realize that I needed a lot more therapy. And it made me also go back and work back through some of those situations that really got stuck inside of me.
Mm. Let's get right into it. Let's talk about your book, Pretend They Are Dead, A Father's Search for the Truth. Take us away with the title to begin with, which I thought was very hard when I got to understand why you chose this title. But tell us a little bit about this title.
Sure. My biological father left us. He was actually a veterinarian, and he lived in the same town, Wayne, New Jersey, that I lived in, lived within 2 miles. And I always said to myself, like, it probably would have been better just to be adopted at birth as opposed to being rejected, abandoned, and then adopted by my other father when I was eight or 9 years old is when I eventually was adopted. I had a different name. When I started searching, and I'll get into this a little bit later, but what I discovered after my biological father passed away, he died, was I found out that he had been a writer, and not just a veterinarian, but a writer. And I wound up with thousands of pages of his writings, magazine articles, journals. But there was one story that I did not wind up with, but what kept being mentioned in correspondence that he had. This is all after he died, and I'll work backwards. But to get to the title, I got a magazine article called Hello Yellow, and it was a story of the last night that my father spent with me and my sister and my brother, and we were just little kids. And he published this story in the mid-70s, and Hello Yellow was a poem that I apparently as a little kid had come out for some water and told Dad, hey, Daddy, I have a poem, having no idea what was about to happen. So this is a story that he wrote. And in it, he said he went to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist told him the best thing for you and for the kids is just pretend they are dead. Mm. And that's what he did. He dropped us off the morning after we told the story. He dropped us off and he never came back. And so in looking back at that story, pretend they are dead, that's exactly what he did. And that's a coping mechanism. That was a coping mechanism for me growing up because I just forgot about him, you know?
Thank you for sharing. And fast forward, this is where your book, even in the intro, you are a writer by far and long. I don't know what your dad had done before, but I know what you got, my friend, and you got a gift. It is a way of storytelling that is really impactful. 16 years old, take us away. You're on the tennis court. This was part of the book at the beginning. Tell us walk through that.
Sure. I was 16, and I always tell my clients, actually, now, I wasn't a member of the tennis club. I worked at the tennis club. I wasn't in one of those families. So I was the only person working at this tennis club in New Jersey. It was July 4th of 1975. I was the only person there. I'm sweeping the courts. It was a clay court. And you kind of sweep them and roll them and do all these things. And I hear this car screeching. A car hits a telephone pole, just the noise and the smell. And I don't know if you've ever seen a car accident. I hadn't seen one. Your heart, it was just like slow motion. You know, it's surreal. And I saw that a man went through the windshield of the car. And it was an Impala. And I remember running over there, trying to figure out what to do, run to the payphone that's at the tennis court at the club, you know, pick it up, call the operator. I'm shaking. I don't know what's happening. Run back over there. Some people had gathered around, and by this time they have the guy on the ground, and his face was split in two because he went through the windshield. He was conscious, unconscious, whatever. And as I'm standing there, and I ridden my bike to the thing. I got this really weird feeling, like something came over me. Like, you know, when someone's staring at you and just know, why is that person looking at me? And I look and I see this guy just staring at me with his face cut in two and all this. And he's in bad shape. And I'd never seen anybody like that before. And the police officer pulls out his wallet and says, does anybody know this man? His name's Alan Nessel. And I didn't say anything. I just got on my bike and rode home. And didn't tell anybody, but Alan Nessel is my biological father.
How difficult that was for you. And when I got an opportunity, and readers and listeners from my show would get an opportunity when they purchased this book, how chilling that was for you. Even at such a young age, you had to incorporate manhood in an instant. You go home and you said mom knew something was up, couldn't really explain what it was. There was something going on. How difficult was it for you to carry that truth with you from a person who had been giving you so many lies through the short time that you met him?
You know, I think the reality is because I grew up in this crazy household, I was used to chaos. And by getting on my bike, my Schwinn Varsity, and riding back home, I just remember the ride back home. I just kept it inside of me. Like my mom could tell like I was a little bit off, but you know, when you got seven brothers and sisters and you have a screaming man in there, you're just trying to dodge bullets. I just put it away. I just put it away like it never happened. I went that night to my buddy's house and we hitchhiked to the fireman's fair, whatever it was. Didn't tell him about it. I told him we're still very close friends. Did not tell him about it until about 3 years ago. I told him what happened that night. I just couldn't tell anybody. It just, and I just knew, I didn't know how my father, the father that had adopted me would react in the household, because everything was, you took a risk, man. Anytime you, you took a risk, I was in one of those houses. What kind of mood's he in? You know, can I talk to him about anything? So, so I just carried it.
You know, thinking about your book, when you're finished with the last page of your book, will you feel a sense of closure, or did you feel a sense of closure, or did it open more emotional doors for you?
I think I felt a certain amount of closure, especially finishing when I finished the book, you know, and actually went through the re-editing process and all that. I felt some closure because, you know, the circumstances in which I found out the truth, which was after my father had died, and I got all of his journals and writings and realized that why he did what he did, and that he loved us. So it did, it gave me some closure. But is there ever really closure? I mean, there's that word, oh, you have closure, but is, you know, I still go to therapy because I don't have complete closure, but definitely felt, I felt a connection with my past, and also, what a loss, you know, a loss for any kid to lose a parent, to have a father who lived down the street and just, like, you know, just ignored you.
You know, the one thing about you, Stephen, that I learned, the author, Stephen, now, that within your writing, you found coping, you found ways to let out. But what I got to learn from you was what an incredible dad you are. Is as if you bust your tail double time to make sure that you're not running the same laps that were run on you when you were growing up, that you have fought extremely hard. And I'm so proud as a man to also share that with our listeners, that you have worked extremely hard, even though that the marriages did not work. You have worked your tail off to make sure that your children are respected, heard from, and that you do everything possible. So really kudos to you on that. And I want to also ask you about your children in referencing the book. What has been the most surprising reaction you have gotten from them in relation to this book?
It's, well, if I can get, let's see, one of my sons has read it. I have five children. I adopted one. I think the most surprising thing was my daughter, who's out in California. She works with Nick Kroll. She's in comedy. But my daughter was scared to death about the book because of what her mother, who is my first wife, might say about it. And I said, I sent the book to your mom. I wanted her to read it, and because I knew how you would feel. And she told me, Steve, this book's going to be a bestseller. It's incredible. That's what my ex-wife said. And my daughter said, well, Dad, I just don't want you to think you're like this perfect dad. You know, you weren't perfect. And I said, okay, so that was kind of like a very honest response. But, you know, I'm not sure what a perfect dad is. I'm sure I'm not perfect, but that was a great response. She's like afraid to read it, but it was a good move on my part. I must say, to have my ex-wife read it. It got the clear answer.
You know what? Children, they are our hardest critics anyway. Let's talk about the first chapter a bit, the Tug McGraw chapter. You speak about how a brief moment can really stay with us for life. Can you share with us that memory, and why does this still tug at your, you know, heartstrings?
That's a great question. How one little thing sticks with you. We all look for mentors and role models, I guess. And I loved sports, man. From the time I was young, I loved baseball. I loved sports. I always have, still do. And I didn't have anybody to play catch with. My biological father was gone. My new father was not, you know, you didn't play sports with him. That just wasn't part of it. But I was always looking for my friends' dads, you know, that maybe I'd go play catch with them. But I was a New York Mets fan, and I being from Jersey, and I found out Willie Mays was going to be at Builders Emporium. I have the newspaper article from that back, and I have it. I went to Builders Emporium. It was freaking packed because everybody wanted to meet Willie Mays. And off in the corner, like in the in the garden section or something, was Tug McGraw, who nobody really knew at that time who he was. It was before he was Tug, you know. I went over. I had earlier gone to. I rode my bike to a place to meet Willis Reed to like get his autograph. We played for the Knicks, and too many people were there, and I didn't make the cut, so I couldn't. I never did meet Willis. However, so with Willie Mays is there, and you know, greatest ball player of all time. And kids are just mobbing him, and parents are mobbing him, and I'm like, you know, I'm by myself. I was probably nine, so I went over and I saw there was no line where Tug McGraw was, and so I walked over to him, and he just took the time to like. He asked me my name. He asked me if I played baseball, like what position. He signed my ball like to Steve, you know, with the date. I mean, probably 5 minutes, maybe 5 minutes at the most. But he treated me like a person. Like he just, in that little moment, like this baseball player just treated me like a person. And, you know, I have that. I can grab that autographed baseball. I still have it from 1972. I mean, it's within like 5 feet of where I'm sitting right now. I still have it. Wish I had a Sharpie. But I think those little moments in your life, just that one little thing, he gave me encouragement. I never forgot it. It just always stuck with me that guy was nice to me.
You know, it's the power of these small moments. Yeah. Like one unexpected event. You're here to meet the greatest player to ever play the game. You shared within your writing how overwhelmed he may have been just looking to the side. He was already tired, so many people. And yet you make that one connection to Tug McGraw that really spins your life around. And for me, that emotional memory that you have has been able to be paid forward, because now you share this story with your son, and I don't want to get too much about the book, but you're like, he's like, tell me, how did, you know, this is what I think I found about you that really lured me to be connected to, right? Because whether we're joyful or we're painful, we often stay buried until we're triggered, right? And in that sequence, you have maybe the greatest player within a room, and you take the consolation prize. And that turned out to be the biggest thing that you could have done, because many times we have involvement with certain things that we can't really understand. But in the world of parenting, this became one of your greatest stories to tell your own children. And I'm really glad that you were able to stay back and hang to the right and just meet Tug McGraw. Thank you for sharing that. Can you tell me what was the hardest chapter for you to write in this book and why?
There's a few hard chapters. At the time that I was writing the book, most of the book, I had just gotten divorced. And I am happily married now, and that's another part of it. But I'd gotten divorced from my second wife, who I had a child with, but we weren't married very long. But I was alone. I was sitting there alone in a house on 9 acres in 2008 during the real estate crisis. This big house in the middle of Chuliota, Florida, which is like 30 miles outside Orlando. And my wife had a horse rescue, but she left. She left me with my son and moved to Georgia and left me with a house that I couldn't sell. And I was in it by alone. It's like a 45, it's a big house. It's 4,500 square feet. And not only did I take a financial beating of the house, but I was alone. And that's when I decided, okay, I'm going to write, I'm going to get into what my father's stuff had written. And I'm going to just sit and just kind of start journaling or whatever and see what happens. So that was a really tough time to do it, but I was inspired. And then writing certain chapters about it, like a fight that I had or flunking out of school moving to Florida was horrible. Those are tough chapters. The moving to Florida chapter was difficult.
Again, this is going to be a bestseller, no doubt. I can clearly tell you that, and I have to agree with your first wife. But you wrote about this fight with Richard. And before we get into the fight, tell us a little bit about Richard. He enters your life shortly after dad is gone. Walk us through, as soon as he gets into this house, what is his style like?
His style, I don't know if you call it style. He was like, he was just mean. He was just one of the meanest. He was a hard ass. I mean, just really tough. He had a tough upbringing. He was from Brooklyn and not a lot of money. He boxed in the army. He was a tough guy. He was a tough guy with a big chip on his shoulder. And he moved into our house. And I was, since I was the oldest son, you know, he had to make me tough, you know, and that was a big thing. The boys had to be tough. You know, we had to fight. We had to learn how to stick. You know, then there are certain benefits to that. But he was a yeller. Like, he just came into the house, and if you did not do what he said, it was either physical or just, you know, screaming at you. And the screaming, calling you names was worse. So I wasn't used to that. And then public fighting with my mother, I wasn't used to that. So that was, we never had a conversation. He adopted me. So I took his last name. And I became an Eichenblatt. My name had been something different. And he spent most of his time calling me a loser, telling me that I would never amount to anything, just not supportive. And he treated most of the kids like that. It wasn't just me, because I wasn't his blood. He didn't treat his kids that much better. He was just a difficult man. He was a bully. He was your classic bully, who just, people were afraid of him and wouldn't stand up to him. And I saw him get in many fights, push people around.
You know, the thing about time, though, it has a funny way of creeping up on us. And you weren't no slouch anyway. Growing up, you were athletic. You had nice build. You were always physical in sports and things of that nature. But this fight, you're 17 years old. What did that confrontation teach you about boundaries and emotional truths? Because you've kind of had enough.
Yeah. I think it's really good for people that this story is really interesting, because I am not a fighter. Like, I was a quiet kid, stayed out of the way, stayed out of the house as much as I could. I mean, you know, my grades were terrible, but nobody was paying any attention because they had all this other stuff going on. But the last thing I was a fighter. I was not like, yeah, I was very athletic. I was good at, and I wish I couldn't play high school sports, because I had no way of getting to my high school, no transportation except for like hitchhiking and all that stuff. But when I was 17, they moved us to Florida. I lived in one place, one high school my entire life, and they moved us to Florida. I had families that wanted me to stay there with them that were like, man, Steve, you can stay with us. You're easy. You know, you're easygoing, not a troublemaker. But we all moved to Sarasota, Florida, which was in those days, it was a farming town, cattle ranching town. I wasn't used to that. Richard did not have a job. So he was home every day, every time we'd walk in, and you'd walk in the house and he would just mess with you. You know, he would just mess with you, pick on you. He'd call my mother fat. He would call my brother retarded. He would just mess with you. And one day I walked in there and he messed with me, and I just completely lost it and just decked him. I mean, it was like the devil was inside me. I mean, it was like, It's like you see these football players that when they go on the field, they just take all that anger and they boom. And that's how it was. Like I just exploded. I exploded on him, and which no one had ever seen anybody stand up to him before. And we had this huge fight, and I got kicked out of the house. And years later, my mother said she was proud of me. But back then, he wound up in the hospital. It was bad.
You know, we're not here celebrating because we definitely don't like violence. And we don't want children who listen to our show to say this is the best way to get up against my stepfather or my father or my adopted father. But estrangement and this unspoken pain really brings a lot. You know, children carry their own truths about what it means to them, about distance and silence that sometimes these caregivers give us. There is a mental health connection because parents and children, how were you able to connect with your mom? And probably years later, she said, I was very proud of you, but I'm wondering how difficult was this for her to say, how many times am I going to be able to mess up? And I'm trying to do it for my kids, and maybe they don't understand what I'm trying to accomplish here. So much to really talk about. And I'm really proud that you're able to tell this story today. And once again, saying it in a way that you needed to do something to protect your family. It cost you, but I guess that it did earn you the respect that sometimes is often lost. Let's talk about if one of your children were to write a book about you, what do you think that they would say?
What would they say? They would say that, I'm quirky and I'm funny and I'm too easy on them. But I'm a committed dad that is there for them, you know, too much, you know, texting them at 2 a.m. just to mess with them. And they would say, my kids love me, you know, I'm not a hard ass with them. I don't spoil them. I disciplined them when they needed to be disciplined. But most of them didn't. And my kids laugh. They call me Wild Steve. that's a whole nother story, but they do.
You know, the one thing that I captured within glimpses of reading about you and reading parts of this book was, again, your positivity towards your kids, how hard you work on your fatherhood, and how hard you work on keeping that fatherhood game available. It's not about what you buy for them or what you can supply. It's your creativity as soon as you see them. You got something to say. You have humor. You have stories to tell them. They ask of stories. Even if your son is not that athletic, you make sure you're cheering them on to the fullest degree of all degrees. And this is what makes me proud of you, again, your ability to do this. When our listeners purchase your book and they get to open it, what is something we've not talked about that they'll be surprised about your life?
What have I not talked about? When I think of, you know, I mean, I don't spend any time on the book talking about some of my proudest accomplishments and craziest accomplishments as an attorney, that because I've spent a lot of time helping children outside of my family. And I've handled some really very significant cases. And there are certain families whose kids maybe had a catastrophic situation that I still keep in touch with. And I have become part of my life, and part of my kids know them. So I don't talk a lot about, you know, that piece. And I don't really talk about my kids in the book because I wanted to respect, you know, their privacy. But I will tell you, being a dad who has had, you know, 5 kids, I definitely encourage them to do what they want to do. I didn't want to force them down you must go to college. You know, I want them to be happy and explore, you know, go explore things. I lived in Israel. So My one of my sons is on his way to Alaska. He's going to work on a salmon gill netting boat in the Bering Sea. He's 18. And a lot of my friends are like, you're going to let your son do that? I go, I'm going to let my son do whatever he thinks he can do. You know, if that's what he wants to do. My other son wanted to go to Nashville and be a guitar superstar. And I'm totally supportive. That's what you want to do, man. Go for it. My daughter does stand-up comedy. Go for it, you know, and you'll have plenty of time to become a lawyer or whatever, you know, whatever it is. So that's not exactly an answer to your question, but I don't spend a lot of time talking about my kids. So
no, it does. And it once again highlights how genuine you are as a person. You have a diverse group here. They're going to become different leaders in different walks of life. And here you are clapping on no matter what. What can you tell a father who purchases your book, and what do you wish that they can learn from when someone is struggling in silence? What is something that they can learn?
Sure. I think one of the main things is to tell your kids, even when it's hard, because it was hard for me, to tell them that you love them, to hug them, to be physical, to be warm, to let them know that you are there for them no matter what, to let them know that it is okay. You're going to make mistakes. So, you know, reach out to me. I'm not going to get angry if you wind up having a bunch of drinks and you don't have money to Uber. I'm not going to be mad at you if you call me and ask me for a ride. You know, don't be afraid for fathers out there, I think it's really important that, and we all have different situations. I was a divorced dad, and I made sure that my kids, I'd go to their practices, and I didn't necessarily have to like jump on top of them, but they knew I was there. I knew I was there. So, you know, I've represented dads who are incarcerated, and they're actually, some are really great dads because their kids know that they care. They know they care and they make contact. So, you know, let your kids know you love them.
Here on this platform, we always talk about people being labeled and called out for things. And usually men do get this. You're emotionally disconnected, and you named that earlier. How did being emotionally disconnected in your marriage affect your children, even if they didn't see everything about it? Like, what was that like?
I think in some ways I wasn't, I was connected to them like with love, but I was always like sort of missing. I could never figure it out. Like, what is it you're missing? What is it you're missing? Like, and maybe it was just warmth or the physical part, but I think my kids, they pick up on a lot of cues. And of course, you know, my marriages were different, you know, different. So depending on how my ex was at the time, it was that, you know, they certainly, and this is important to know, is, you know, your kids see everything, they hear everything, they see everything, you know, and if they see you fighting or you're being disrespectful to your wife or she's being they see all of that. So I think my kids saw my struggle within myself. I think they saw that too.
You know, you've done, and we talked about the courtroom just a bit, but the work that you've done to support families, and now you have made them part of your family. Some of the people who you have defended have now become part of your family. And that's something to be, you know, very happy about, because sometimes we don't know where the love is going to come. And learning about these support systems is not only useful, but is important. Because in order for them to trust you within the work, in order for them to believe after losing loved ones that they have someone in you that can do that, you are now bringing this twofold, and you've brought this in into your inner family set as well, which is something to be very happy about. Do you believe that forgiveness and reconnection are always possible? Because with your bio father, you had these times that you may have been upset, you were just totally upset with him, or were you able to forgive him at some point?
I mean, it reminds me of closure, you know, so you can forgive somebody, but it may not excuse them, I guess, you know. So yeah, for me, like I did forgive him once I understood why he did what he did. Unfortunately, by the time I was able to forgive him, he had already passed away. But I did come to a calmness in my heart with him, understanding the situation he was in, some of the obstacles that he faced. He had his own drug issues and a lot of other things going on that I didn't learn till later on. So I think if you can, we all have family situations, every single person does. And forgiveness is a strong, it's not, for some people, it's really hard to say they're sorry or they won't. And it's just two words, but it gets you together. It triggers that, okay, I'm going to sit down with them and we're going to agree to disagree on things, because we're all going to disagree on certain things and try to get past it. And for me, I was able to get past it with my biological father. I can't say I've forgiven my father who adopted me. I mean, I've come to terms with it, and I don't, but you know, I'm not going to sit here and say, oh yeah, I forgave him and it's all good, because he's dead anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And that's a lot to really carry. But what do you think is one of the hardest truths for a father like Richard, who has to look back on some of his decisions as you're aging and before you leave this earth? What do you think fathers like him are facing when they have to face those real truths?
Well, you know, if they face them, because a lot of times they refuse to face them. But I think fathers like him, and maybe even him at the end, they look back and realize that there's not a lot of people there who care about them, that there's not a lot of friendships there, that I know with Richard, because he was a bully, people hung out with him because a lot of times they were just afraid of him, and he was the leader, or he was funny at other people's expenses. But, you know, once he got sick or was in need, there was nobody there for him. And so I think him reaching out and saying he was sorry would have probably gone a long way.
It's interesting, because there's a word like karma is what they call it, right?
Yeah.
You have to deal with some of this. You got to get it. But this sort of trauma that he may have been experiencing, I don't know him, but it could have been of something that he couldn't heal. And so he just passed it on. That was just the best way for him to do it. I mean, just give it forward. Sometimes we often absorb some of this unspoken pain. And the way that we kind of show it is by duplicating it. We often hear that a family member who's a drinker, the child grows up and he or she learns to do that because it's an immediate trauma response to what they learn from their parents. But oftentimes breaking that cycle, which is what I found you to try to do for your life, and you're like still fighting for that, you know, healing takes time, and it can put us in a place of not understanding who we really are. And that's why the grit that you show is really something that fathers who do get to meet you will really respect about you, because I feel that we get such a bad rap, men, for various reasons. Sometimes we deserve it, sometimes we don't, but there are reasons why we try to be that protective force. And people like the ones that we talked about, like Richard, he doesn't heal because he doesn't want to pass on. He believes that changing or transforming change is going to make him soft or people right. Not love him. But yet exactly. A person like you comes along, and you have experienced this two times within your whole lifetime. And yet your driving force, even though that the marriages didn't work at the beginning, they were telling you, I need to break this cycle. I need to not have my kids be like that. And I think that that's what you've poured into, unless I'm saying something different, but I really do understand that sometimes what we can't heal doesn't mean we need to really pass it on.
Yeah, that's you make a great point. And one of the things I do talk about too in the book is my biological father, his father left him. And so there was definitely a, and his brother left his kids. And there's this whole cycle of of abandonment, you know, of dads just disappearing on in my family. And that was something that probably kept me in a marriage too long, my first marriage, because there's no way I was going to leave my kids, man. There's no way. And, you know, we were able to work it out, but so it wasn't leaving my kids, but it was being a divorced dad and sharing custody and doing those things. But trying to stop that cycle you gotta get a handle on it.
Well, keep on, brother. We are sending you positive energy, and I know you're standing up to represent us every day of your life. So thank you. I want to also think about this. You wrote this book, 12 years in the making. Was there anything you left out, by the way, that now you're like, oh my God, I should have put that in there?
Well, you know, the main thing I left out, and which you mentioned like very briefly, but there's just so many things, but I was honored to represent, you know, some of the victims of 9/11 and their families as a pro bono lawyer. I got trained. And if you saw the movie Worth, I went, and I tried cases in Brooklyn with Kenneth Feinberg, who was the victims. He's the one who decided what every life was worth. There was a movie last year with Michael Keaton who talked about that. And I was able to represent families of firefighters and a guy named Leon Express Smith. It's an incredible guy. I didn't know him because he died, but I got to know his wife and his kids, and I still talk to them. But he was driving the fire engine, I think it was ladder 118, over the Brooklyn Bridge. There's this very famous picture of him driving the engine over the Brooklyn Bridge into the fire. So all those guys on that fire engine knew that they were driving into the towers and probably not coming back. I mean, the guy is a real, real hero. And I wrote a whole story about that because I brought my son to one of the hearings, and he wound up becoming a lawyer himself because he was inspired to help other people. So, but that's for another, just at some point, you know, there's just only so much you can, the book would be too long. So I took that out.
Well, based on your writing skills, brother, I feel like you need to write some more. I don't know if you're going to do another 12 years, but I'm saying those of us that get an opportunity to read this book, pretend they are dead, will definitely see your writing technique is incredible. A wordsmith, just letting the words come out and you really get into the story. I want to talk a little bit without any kind of area around this or that, but what do you think your mom says about this book?
My mom was supportive along the way. I would send her chapters and all that because, you know, I wanted her to know I was writing it, and it wasn't going to be dishonest. Before I had it finally published, I got a great publisher and all that, but I sent the manuscript to my sister and I said, what do you think mom's going to say? And she said, well, she's not going to like it, but you were pretty easy on her. I sent the manuscript to her. She's 88, and her initial reaction was, I'm going to commit suicide if you publish this. Mm. And I said, Mom, that's exactly the problem. This is not about you. This is not a story about you. You're barely mentioned. This is my journey. And once she got over that initial, like, of course she's not going to look. People are going to say, well, what was your mom doing? And, you know, she was a battered woman. And she knew she should have left earlier. So I think it's she's actually come around like quite a bit and been really supportive and really tried to, it's going to be hard when it comes out, when it's actually published in people's hands. But I don't use her name and she's not, I do my best to soft pedal. So, you know, that's a hard thing when you write a memoir, if it's going to be truthful, you know, you're going to hurt some people.
It's the hard truth. What advice would you give a father who kind of feels disconnected from his children right now?
I would say, you know, just keep focusing on being connected, even if it's a text message. And even if they don't respond, if you just tell them every day that you love them, they'll know that you're there. When my kids don't respond, I look at it like they know I'm there, because we have all these ways of communication. So no matter what, put your kids first, you know, and know that they're you are their role model. You're an example for them, and you know, you don't have to buy them fancy things, but if you can, you know, I love to take my kids fishing or walking, or, you know, I don't buy them fancy things. It's just not how I am. But, you know, those little things mean everything. Show up for their events, you know, show up for their practices. I watch my kids practice and I'd be like in the outfield and they could barely see me, but they knew I was there, you know, they knew I was there. So pay attention to them when you're with them. Don't be on your phone, you know, make them put their phone away. Well, you know, it depends on the age, but a great day is when I communicate one way or another with most of my kids every day. And it's, you know, even if it's a one word, you know, I got four boys and the text messages are three words or less. So, but that's enough. That's enough. Then my daughter wants to talk and I'm like, yeah.
So, okay. Well, we at least know that you broke the writer's block for them. Let's see what they can do.
Exactly. That's Stephen, right.
You've worked with so many families during 9/11 in the courtroom, first responders and so on. Has there been a story that sometimes you think about and reminds you that you need to keep up the good fight? Can you share with us which story, without naming the family, of course, really moves you in a way that you understand more work needs to be done?
Sure. Well, one story, one family in particular that I represented, there was multiple kids from multiple mothers, but there was only one father, and not all the mothers knew about all the kids. So there was, and some of those kids, they were really destitute, you know, poor families. And it was just like really unfortunate situations. And I was able to, at least through, you know, you have survivor benefits. There are survivor benefits, and this isn't a get rich thing. And these kids have lost their father. And it was reconciling the relationships within the core group. You have three or four women who are the moms, and then you have the one dad who's passed away, and then you have five or six kids, and trying to keep the kids together as a unit, if possible, which has actually happened in with one of this one particular family I'm helping, and then just being for me trying. Just being them, knowing that if there's something pops up, they can call me and I could try to guide them. And I still do that once in a while, whenever they call me, you know.
Thank you so much, friend, for sharing that intimate story. And again, it just really shows to what may have been a difficult childhood for you. You have erased that to make adulthood that sweeter. So thank you really for making change in so many ways. What do you do for self-care? All this time that you got, you're giving stuff away. You keep doing stuff for people.
Dude,
everybody, what do you do, friend?
I'm insane. Man. That's the problem. It's, you know, you grow up, you know, I'm a huge runner. I play tennis as much as I possibly can. I've had two hip replacements. I've had a shoulder replacement. I compete. I'm just a competitor, you know, so I love to just get out there, and I love to fish. And I love to be in the woods. So that to me is, you know, I love nature. So I do a lot of stuff like outside with that. And, you know, and I read, you know, I read and follow sports and all that. But I love being, I'm not an indoor, even though I'm a lawyer, people think I'm homeless because I walk the streets around my office all the time, just because I just got to be moving. So I'm working on trying to contain it, but I think exercise and nature, you know, nature is really healthy. You know, even if you live in the city, finding a place that you can, you know, just settle in and, you know, look at birds. Or my kids laugh at me, but but I have a sensitive side.
Good stuff. Before we let you go, friend, the floor is yours. Tell our listeners about your book, what you want them to take away from this. And when someone says to someone else, pretend they are dead, what do you want them to know?
Sure. Well, first of all, I want people to buy the book. It's on, you can get it on Amazon, Pretend They Are Dead, Stephen Scott Eichenblatt. I think that's, and when you buy the book, I just want you to think about, you know, your own family and your own situation and the choices that you've made. And we all make bad choices at some point in our lives, and our kids are going to make bad choices, but you can navigate your way out of those choices and for your kids and for yourself. And there's a time in for me where I realized if I didn't get my stuff together, nobody was going to do it for me. You got to do it on your own. So, I really appreciate, you taking the time to talk to me, and it's been a great talk, and I really hope people will learn and buy and contact me. If you got any problems, man, just call me. I'm around.
Thank you so much for that, brother. And I want to just say that I will have a link to your book on my website as well to bring up that support. You know, the thing about therapy and trauma is that sometimes letting it go, it just takes time. Sometimes getting back to the real you takes longer than expected. Sometimes you need to just cut through the chase and live your best life to the fullest. Don't let anyone step into your dreams with their nightmares. Because on this platform it was built. Because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels the need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Stephen, thank you so much for such an amazing conversation.
Thanks, Jules. Really, really appreciate it. I'm a fan now. I'll be following you for sure.
Right back.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa. This is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde de la Rosa. Esto va dedicado a ti.